Welcome. This episode of Inside the Genome is a recent recording of Myriad Oncology Live, a webinar hosted by me, Dr. Thomas Slavin, Chief Medical Officer for Myriad Genetics. The opinions and views expressed in this recording do not necessarily represent those of Myriad Genetics or its affiliates. To participate in a future recording, please visit Myriad Live for a list of dates, times, and subjects. I look forward to exploring the world of genetics with you all. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Myriad Live. Thanks for coming on this early Monday morning. Appreciate everyone coming. We tend not to do them this early on a Monday, but we're accommodating some travel schedules today. So appreciate everyone's enthusiasm for coming on for this important discussion. As always, I'll start with a little housekeeping. We have our Myriad Live webpage. So if looking for the schedule, it's all right here. So we have September. Today we're tackling, it's already almost mid-September. It's insane how fast things are going. But we're going to be talking about equity in breast cancer and hereditary cancer risk assessment. And then at the end of the month, we're going to be talking about advances in ovarian cancer treatment and clinical trial matching. So we'll have some special guests on for that as well. And then I'm still trying to slot something in early October. There's a few things up in the air at the moment, but we are going to be coming back with Dr. Adam Brusky later in the month, and we're going to be talking about breast cancer molecular profiling and genomics. And if this is your first time on, this is a very casual, open format. We really encourage questions. If anything's on your mind, they are theme based. So today is really equity and breast cancer. But hey, if you have a question about colon cancer, it's just on your mind and you want to get it out there, feel free. If we have time, we can try to address it. But yeah, we tend to do these theme-based, but definitely encourage everyone to ask their questions and contribute to the conversation. And then we do record these and we'll put them all up on Inside the Genome. So here's a link to the podcast for those that want to go on. And if it says Myriad Live in front of it, it's from one of these. And if it doesn't, and here's Dr. Stitt right here. Evie, thank you for we just posted this one. So if everybody wants to hear more of Dr. Stitt, then we have a side podcast. Now these are usually about 20 minutes. Just kind of one-on-one podcasts. But if they say Myriad Live, they're the 60-minute thing. So there's plenty of content on there, so you can enjoy. And if you're looking for something to do this fall, there you go. I just filled your time. Let me stop sharing there. And we have two great guests with us, but even before that, I want to introduce Shelley Cummings. So thanks, Shelley, for coming on. If you have questions and you want to send them to, you can either send them to the chat, or even better yet, if you could send them to Shelley, it's really up to you. We can make sure they get addressed. And then without further ado, we have two fantastic physicians with us today. So we have Dr. Haywood Brown, who I had the pleasure of meeting briefly at ACOG this year. He was a former ACOG president. He was chair of OBGYN at Duke. He's now a professor at my old alma mater, USF, University of Southern Florida. He is a professor of OBGYN there, as well as a senior associate vice president of faculty affairs and associate dean of diversity. So excited to have him joining us today. And then we have Dr. Efi Stitt is a board certified OBGYN, and she is completely dedicated to women's health initiatives. She's a very passionate individual. I've had many interactions with her that have all been fantastic. She really has an interest in genetics and education. She's in Annapolis, Maryland, and she serves as medical director for Luminous Health. So thank you both for coming on. I really appreciate it. Feel free to unmute yourselves. I think we can start first with just how, I know there's some content, you wanted to go through too, but maybe just a little backstory first. How you got involved in thinking about equity and breast cancer care and genetics in general. I don't know who wants to start first. Maybe Dr. Brown, since I see you unmuted yourself.
Well, sure. Well, first of all, thank you all very much for having me. I've spent, I guess, the last 30 years of my academic career focusing on women's health equity and racial disparities in health and population health outcomes. Although I'm a maternal fetal medicine subspecialist, I live in the space of women's health in general, and particularly all aspects of it. And so I focus primarily for the last several years on maternal morbidity and mortality, but I've always looked at the entire women's health profile and commented on things like, breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening, colon cancer screening, et cetera, et cetera. And the big issue, of course, is the disparity between breast cancer and endometrial cancer and all those type of things. And so for the last several years, I've been really focusing on things like breast cancer care, disparity in breast cancer care. I had the pleasure of serving on the presidential advisory for the National Cancer Institute, along with Dr. Edith, who's at Penn, at Jefferson. And I got to participate in the cervical cancer issues, but also got very involved in the breast cancer prevention and screening guidelines, and knows how confusing they've been over the years. And so this is the focus of my work. And recently, I've been really engaged in trying to bring healthcare navigation to rural access communities where breast cancer screening and income impacts one's ability to get screened, and so forth and so on. So we've been very involved in that. So that's basically my space, particularly in breast and cervical cancer, but primarily focusing right now on breast cancer and its challenges and so forth and so on.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you so much for coming on today. Excited to hear, from your lens and expertise, a little of the backstory of the education you're going to provide for all of us. But Ify, if you want to introduce yourself and give a little backstory.
Yes. Thank you so much, TJ, for having me again. I'm really excited to be part of this today. I'm going to apologize because my gardeners are outside and I'm trying to get them to be quiet. So if I intermittently mute, please forgive me. I'm sorry about that. The woes of trying to do Zoom meetings.
looks like your gardener, at least from the picture, looks like your gardeners are about 54.
I've done a great job.
Exactly. So, Dr. Brown, kind of mentioned, this is just something I think we're all very passionate about. And, I've had the opportunity to act on a more direct level with patients. My why came in the form of a young lady named Brittany. Brittany was one of my patients when I was, early in my career. I'd gotten a couple years under my belt, so I felt, that I was doing pretty, good with making sure I identified my patients and making sure that all of my patients had the appropriate risk assessment. I was feeling at my best, and this young lady comes across my desk. She has a miserable OB history, and she's a new patient to me. And despite her miserable OB history, I focused on that. But after getting her through her pregnancy, I realized maybe about 6 to 9 months later, when she comes back for her postpartum visit, that I completely missed her family history. She had a mom who had breast cancer at age 35, and it recurred at age 38. Her mom's sister had breast cancer in her also late 30s with a recurrence in her early 40s, a grandmother with ovarian cancer, an uncle with prostate cancer, another uncle with pancreatic cancer. Completely missed all of this. So of course, when we tested her, we figured out, okay, she's a BRCA1 mutation carrier, but that wasn't what got me. What got me was the fact that her mom and her sister already knew that they were BRCA1 carriers, but nobody ever discussed it in the family. And that's my why. I think that, as physicians, and even for our patients, it's one thing to certainly identify your patients, but making sure that you kind of make sure they empower them to make sure they know that this is something that will affect generations. have to make sure that you communicate these things. And as providers, we have to do a better job of educating our patients. And I think, you know, along with Dr. Brown, part of the racial disparities issue is education and making sure that all of our patients are aware of what is accessible to them and making sure that they utilize it. So that's my why.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's a pretty powerful one. So thank you.
Can I add one other personal experience absolutely. That happened in the last couple of years that really kind of brought this home to me again? So I received a phone call from my nephews by marriage, and his wife had been diagnosed with breast cancer postpartum. And sadly, she already had metastatic disease. And so her treatment was being delayed. I mean, she had a four-year-old and she had pretty much a three-month-old. And then, you know, when talking to her, you know, I could not believe the fact, first of all, that she obviously had to have a breast mask when she was pregnant.
Yeah.
But also the fact that now she had this strong family history. She literally, her mother had breast cancer, premenopausal breast cancer. She had never been told that she really probably had hereditary breast cancer. And it was amazing to me that here are people who are, you know, sitting here at the income bracket, but yet really not having a good history taken, because if they had taken that history of her, clearly they would have noted that she had, you know, a family member, a mother who had breast cancer. So it turns out, to make a long story short, we basically got her referred appropriately because the hemoc person that she was seeing was kind of lackadaisical about it. And I felt that almost written her off because she already had bone mets. And I said, come on, people. I said, you know, postpartum, a three-year-old and a four-month-old, why hasn't she started treatment? So I ultimately ended up getting her referred someplace else. And then, of course, the people kind of got involved, because I told her husband, I said, you just got to say, I want to live, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And lo and behold, all's well's end well, because now she's doing very well. But she ended up having her treatment ultimately transferred right there to GW and then to Hopkins. But that's basically a story of how we take for granted and we don't do a good job. And again, we got to get providers to not only stand genetic risk, but also environmental risk, and also not to ignore people based on who they look like and what they look like and so forth and so on. So equity is still a big issue for me and having us to recognize those things. So I will stop with that. But that is a personal story. I mean, and it just kind of overwhelmed me being an MFM and being and seeing patients all the time and this and never really. And of course, because I have a background in genetics, I'm always taking a genetics history, but that's a different story.
Yeah, yeah, no, sometimes things that look obvious are not obvious to all. It's amazing. Let me share these slides. So this was a presentation that you both gave at ACOG that I have here that, you know, seems like good background on all this to dive even deeper. I don't know who wants to really, you know, I can go through some slides. I don't know, you know, maybe where you want to start, but there's some nice facts and figures in here for sure.
Dr. Brown, do you want to start with the front part?
Yeah, let me start with this part, and I'm not going to, I don't think I want to belabor this much with these numbers and so forth and so on, but I think this does raise the point of what we're going to be talking about today, and thank you for sharing this, Tom, and I'll let you move through it. So basically, you know, my whole focus on breast cancer and breast cancer disparity, it really lies here. You know, having family members, not personal, but a lot of friends, you know, it's interesting to me that when you think about this, we know that there are risks. You can go ahead to the next couple of slides, Tom.
Flip it around a little bit.
Yeah, keep it. So leave it right here. Leave it right here at this one. The next one. Sorry.
This one. Yeah, sorry.
So here we go. And when you think about African-Americans, it's diagnosed at a later stage than whites and non-Hispanic patients. And breast cancer mortality is still highest among African-Americans. Black women experience a 40% higher mortality rate. Now, we'll realize that's not necessarily because of mammography. It may be because the fact that they get They have maybe more advanced disease. Maybe there's delay. Maybe they cannot follow the guidelines, even though guidelines say, let's get screened at age 40. You can't get screened if you have access issues, if you have poverty issues. And I think that that's the thing that really concerns me. So when you look at this whole issue here of looking at the incidence of breast cancer, you can see that that bar talks a lot about race and ethnicity and how non-Hispanic Blacks and non-Hispanic whites pretty much have, you know, some commonalities there, but we clearly know that they have poor outcomes. Next slide. Now, this is where we are. And so again, if you look at the number of new cases in female breast cancer, again, you see about 125 per 100,000 persons and 128 per 100,000 persons. But we ought to know that our populations, the population of white women versus the population of black women really don't equate when you think about these rates being equal. And so in reality, you're talking about Black women still having a significantly higher rate of breast cancer overall when we look at this number and look at population. And then you look at Hispanics and so forth. So here's the other issue. Next one. Now, the problem that's most concerning is deaths. Mm-hmm. Because if people are diagnosed at the same stage, the death rate is still higher. And so look at the death rate of 29.6 per 100,000. And we're going to, and Dr. Sid would talk a lot about that. That's really where the concern is. So imagine delaying the diagnosis. And I'll use the example of my niece by marriage. You know, diagnosed at a stage 4 postpartum, a young woman, 37 years old, and really already behind with regard to her treatment and so forth and so on. So she has a higher death rate, you know, just based on those type of things. Next slide.
What do you think is going on with these last three columns here? I mean, any thoughts there?
I think that if it talks to you, you're gonna see that, that when you start talking about all of the risks, whether it be diet, whether it be weight, whether it be exercise, whether it be what your SNPs are, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's going to play a role in this because we know that we've got to go beyond just the gene, the BRCA gene, BRCA, BRCA1 and BRCA2, because as we'll get into this, we'll understand that, yes, diet does play a role. Environment plays a role. Where you grow up plays a role. And I always say that if your next door neighbor is 45 and she got diagnosed with breast cancer in my hometown of rural Eastern North Carolina, we all live in the same area. You know, what are the same factors in that environment that really play a role in that next door neighbor? You know, and then maybe changes your risk as well if you're in that same neighborhood. So I think that plays a role in this whole issue. So, 1 in 8 American women, we know that. Breast cancer new patients have steadily increased, and this is exactly what we're talking about beyond genetics. Why have these numbers so dramatically changed? Certainly, they've changed because of screening mammography, but they've also changed because a number of factors have played a role in them changing. And it shows you how relevant this is with regard to incidence and so forth and so on. And that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So next slide.
And I've always personally wondered how much DCIS has played into this as well. I think DCIS is being counted as breast cancer has gone up over the decades. And it's hard to tease out.
Well, I think that this really kind of plays this. You can skip this one because I think we've already talked about this in terms of mortality and diagnosis. And we can let's go ahead and skip this one too. So now let's get to the final one I want to show before we get to that. These are age-specific things. And you begin to kind of think about age-specific. You can see how the longer you live, the greater the risk. And so with regard to when you're going to be diagnosed, and this is why you see these guidelines that are geared around 40 and so forth. So, and they've been that way for a while. But as we know, the new NCCN guidelines would, with all of the factors that we've talked about here, and that Dr. Stitt would say, is pushing that down further and further, you know, with regard to when we ought to start doing breast cancer education. And so people have been stuck in this, well, I don't have to worry about this until I'm 40. I don't have to worry about this until I'm 40. And what we're telling people, well, you do have to worry about it before you're 40, particularly if you know someone or you live in this environment. And so this is why you begin, we need to begin to think about this right at 30, or if you have a family member, even further down, because this is when it starts to go up and so forth and so on. So that's what we're going to talk about today as well. Next one. And I think we've already talked about survival. So next slide. Treatment, next slide. And then I've already talked about survival rates by race, so you can move on. But this is important here, because when you look at non-Hispanic Blacks and you look at states and you look at death by population, this is where my disparity work comes in. You can see that we live in certain belts here compared to non-Hispanic whites, the density of the population. But look at Oklahoma, look at California. And so you think about deaths. What is happening in these areas? Is it access to care? Is it follow-up from care? Is it living in a rural community where you really can't get follow-up? And this brings our breast cancer navigation program into focus and so forth and so on. And so we should not have people dying from breast cancer earlier than they should if they're getting appropriate treatment and have access to all the quality treatment. Next slide.
Yeah, this is a really interesting map.
Yeah,
for sure.
This is very powerful for me. So I'm going to turn this over then to Dr. Stitt in just a minute, but this is why we talk about reducing risk factors. We know that African-American, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dr. Brown.
We know that African-American women, you know, and the weight is an issue, but the one thing that I always talk about is diet. You know, we're a product of our environment in terms of what we eat, what we grew up eating and so forth and so on. And so the idea of fruits and vegetables, exercise, and we don't smoke, and in terms of lower risk of smoking, but less successful in quitting and more likely exposed to secondary hand factors. But I also throw one other factor in there, and that is environmental toxins. I think we all live in redlined communities. I'm looking at that now for things like infant mortality from some work I've done. And so these whole redlined communities and certain zip codes really kind of play a role in that whole income exposures and so forth and so on. And with that, I'm going to stop.
You know, Dr. Brown, I thank you for making that point, because I think that's, you know, to TJ's point earlier, he wondered why, you know, you start, you know, the differential between the risk for women, for Black women. If you look at that chart, also you saw there's a slightly increased risk in the latter tier of that group between Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Latino Americans. You see there's a slightly increased risk in the Native American community. And I think that goes back to exactly what Dr. Brown just mentioned. It's not that slide right there, that 14.7. Mm-hmm. Think about our American Indians and our Alaskan Natives, much, much smaller population of people, but see where that risk is, you know, as close as it is to our Hispanic American patients. And I think a lot of that goes back to redlining and the fact that women in those communities may not have equal access to the quality of care, as well as even just pure access to care. So I think that's a huge point to be made. And I think that's where we see some similarity, so to speak, between Black Americans and people of Native Americans. So TJ, if you could forward back to the next couple slides.
Yeah.
So, and one more. Perfect. So one of the other things that there's been several studies that have identified is that, you know, one of the things that there might be, in addition to the socioeconomic issues, but just access. A study out of the Journal of College of Radiology, the American College of Radiology, found that Black women are less likely to receive two or more screening examinations. In addition, in the advent of digital breast tomosynthesis, or 3D mammograms, that's really been the gold standard, at least for the last 5 to 7 years. And what we find is that Black women tend to have less, still have the same access to mammography, but they're still in many communities using 2D mammography rather than 3D mammograms. The 3D mammograms have been absolutely shown to demonstrate more cancers at earlier stages, allowing for diagnosis of maybe those DCIS type cases where we can, you know, we have a better opportunity to, you know, to interfere and interrupt progression of the cancer. And certainly the last part is many Black women are typically older at their first screen. You know, even though we talk about the fact that, you know, I think it's been drilled into so many of us in med school that you start getting breast screenings at age 40, many Black women are older at their first screen, at their first screening opportunity. And the next slide, we'll talk a little bit more about why that is. In 2021, the Susan G. Komen Foundation did an excellent analysis of breast cancer and racial disparities. What they did was looked at 10 metro areas in the United States, and I happen to live in one of those metro areas, the Washington, D.C. metro area. And what they found was that, of course, as we've been mentioning, that Black women tend to develop breast cancer before age 40 more than our white counterparts. Several, you know, there's lots of different reasons, but one of the issues that they found, they wanted to figure out were how, after adjusting for socioeconomic reasons and the other potential confounders, why even when you have an affluent area, for example, Prince George's County, which is one of the wealthiest counties in the United States, which has a very high number of African-Americans living who have, I think it's about 80% of Blacks are upper middle class in the Prince George's County area. Despite that, we still see these increased numbers of breast cancer, morbidity, and mortality. And one of the things they also found was that oftentimes Black women feel that even when they try to advocate for themselves, they're often, you know, either mocked or even ignored by their providers. And that leads to that decreased or that older age at getting their mammogram screening, or less likely to report, you know, a finding that, you know, they feel, oh, you know what, you don't need to worry about that. So that, you know, that often leads to poorer outcomes ultimately. And then there's another, you know, big issue. A lot of, you know, Black patients are not informed or aware about, you know, genetic testing. You know, I go back to, as a med student, I remember that, you know, when you thought about the BRCA1, BRCA2 mutation, I think all of us, you know, remember when Angelina Jolie announced it, you know, back in, you know, the 20 teens, you know, when she mentioned it, you know, and then you also in med school think it's kind of something that's associated with people who have Ashkenazi Jewish background. Mm-hmm. And I think those little subtle, you know, messages, so to speak, often, you know, lead to an unintentional bias. And I will say, even I will admit that I've been even victim to that. One of my nurses is a Nigerian woman who has a BRCA1 mutation, followed by in my entire practice for, we took care of both, we delivered both of her children. I mean, and she had a sister who died at age 29 of breast cancer. Nobody ever tested her. And so there are even, you know, there are biases, you know, implicit biases, even within all of us that are not intentional, but it's just based on what we've been taught. So that, you know, and that lack of communication, next slide, TJ, please. That lack of communication and, you know, multiple articles have been written that show this, that the utilization of genetic testing is certainly lower in racial minorities. And the key difference and one of the key issues is that physician recommendation is the major contributing factor.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, certainly as we well know, many Black women are, you know, at increased risk for, you know, higher, more aggressive cancers, for example, triple negative breast cancer, inflammatory breast cancers. So as, you know, Dr. Brown mentioned, you know, one of the things in 2018, the Society for Breast Imaging and the American College of Radiology both called for identification and doing a risk assessment on all women, especially starting at age 30. Women who are high risk certainly need to be. And those are women of color. Those are women with a family history of breast cancer. At the bare minimum, a risk assessment should be done for every woman at age 30. Once you identify whether they might be, if they're in a high risk group, then you direct them as they need to be. If they're low risk, they can resume routine mammogram screening at age 40. But the key is making sure that these women are identified.
Yeah. And, you know, this has been a challenge. I mean, how do we get at these women at 30? You know, it is it's a hard group. You know, there's access issues there. You know, and then you have diversity and equity issues as well, overlaying all that. I mean, what have you seen, or have either one of you seen good initiatives going on to really try to target that 30-year-old for risk stratification group?
You know, I think the key is education of physicians. And I think there needs to be a bit of a re-education of physicians. And, you know, I think, you know, even going down to the med school level and reteaching us how to make sure that these folks are well identified. It's one of the things that I've been blessed enough to do, to be having to have the opportunity to go and talk to physicians all across the country. You know, the one thing I remind physicians and providers alike when I see them, like, many women are having children in this age group. And I think it's a great opportunity when you're seeing them for their OB care, you know, and even our MFM colleagues, as Dr. Brown, you know, like Dr. Brown, that is a perfect opportunity. And unfortunately, many women in that age group are busy having babies and they're not literally, you know, taking into consideration their family history. That's my why. When I saw Brittany, and so I've been victim to it as well. I had a perfect, you know, an opportunity where a patient demonstrated and definitely documented what her family history was, but I was so focused on her obstetrical history that I missed the opportunity. I got lucky that I was able to course correct, but that's something that, you know, we're working on teaching. And it's one of the things that we're doing in my practice, where every opportunity that we have to see a patient, we make sure that we're taking the that opportunity to assess their family history.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think this is really key. We have to get this now down to the medical student level, the resident level. But I would also say our partners in women's healthcare are great with our women's health nurse practitioners. You know, what I say currently is that even though every county in the United States does not have a practicing OBGYN, 50% don't, most of them have a practicing family doc, but almost all federally qualified health center clinics where women go to for prenatal care and for well women's care do have women's nurse practitioners, and they are very focused on this. So we have to begin to kind of reprogram people that when that 30-year-old is in your office, you know, you take a history, but you also think about all the things that we're talking about and read. My God, the guidelines are there for us to do better. But what happens, we get stuck into the paradigms of where a person lives, how old they are, what their race and ethnicity is. But we know now that 8 to 10% of the population identifies as two or more races. And so when you think about, when I think about it from the Tay-Sachs disease world and my prenatal diagnosis world, many of the cases of Tay-Sachs now are diagnosing people who are not of Jewish ancestry, or at least they didn't think they were. And so I think the same thing holds true with breast cancer and these type of things. So utilizing a good history and all of the genetic things that we have at our disposal is really what we have to teach, and teach it at a lower age. And one of the things I would say is, just having grown up in a Black community, regardless of your affluence, you know, the C word is really a very, very dynamic. It defines you in such a way. And people are in denial about, you know, these type of things. I think the whole denial thing really came out very well in COVID. You know, you're scheduled for your mammogram. You know you're scheduled for it. You don't really want to have it anyway. And then you get a reason not to go get it. And then you're out. And so you put it off for a year. And so you're more later diagnosed. So I think all of those things play a role in this, in terms of what we talked about.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, let's Let me stop sharing here. Let's pause and see if there's any questions from our audience here, just because we have two esteemed experts on the line. So it's a great time to ask anything on your mind.
Wow.
No questions.
Here's one in the chat.
That is a great question. And I would say this myself, because I have this as a history. Now, my father was diagnosed with colon cancer when I was there in high school. And clearly, when he came home and said he had cancer, you know, and we live in a small town, he said, well, I don't want people to know that I have cancer. And I said, well, you know, and I was kind of pre-med thinking around. I said, why do you don't want people to know you? I mean, you have cancer, yeah. You got to get you treated. And we're just trying to figure out how you can stay alive. And he said, well, you know, I'm just ashamed. I said, why are you ashamed of having, and I'm 17 years old. So why are you ashamed of something you couldn't do anything about? I said, we got to get you treated. And lo and behold, you know, he ultimately succumbed to colon cancer because he was so advanced when he was diagnosed. And I think that really is that stigma. So what it's done for me, of course, because he was diagnosed in his early stage, I started my screening at age 45 because I followed the guidelines. And it's very interesting. Now, when I first got my first screen with my family history, and I was at Indiana at the time, at a university. My insurance company said, we're not covering your colon screen because you're not in a risk group. I said, what do you mean I'm not in a risk group? My dad had colon cancer. Well, you're not 50.
Yeah.
And I said, so again, you have that, and again, you're dealing with everybody catching up to where you are. And we can't afford to have that happen to us now with regard to these type of things. And so that's my personal experience.
I agree. I agree with that. I see actually another question in the chat about, you know, proper family history on file. I think, you know, to both points that Amanda has made, I think also it's a generational thing. Mm-hmm. I would say that older generation, I'm in my 40s, and I find that more of my patients that are in my age group, we find that oftentimes we don't know what our family history is because our parents don't talk about it. Our grandparents didn't talk about it. And especially that's even worse in the Black community. Just as, you know, as Haitman mentioned, you know, cancer is, you know, like, well, they had a women's cancer. We don't know anything about it. It's almost like it's shunned. You know, you have a family history of, you know, you have a cancer, you know, diagnosis, you put it under a rug and you just pretend like it doesn't exist. My hope is that as, you know, if people in my age group would do much better with our children and eventually our grandchildren, with making sure that we pass that information on and make sure that future generations are more aware of exactly what's happening. The second half of that point is, you know, I think they mentioned about proper family history not being on file with primary care physicians. And that is a huge issue. ACOG even says this, that this is something that, you know, identification and you know, determination of a family history is something that must be done on a routine and a regular basis, you know, and I tell patients and I tell other providers all the time, when a woman enters your practice at age 20, 25, their family history is not the same as what it is at age 40 and 45.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. must identify what, you know, every year when a patient comes in, I, you know, not only in our practice, we've not only gotten the providers to do it, we've bought some, you know, some involvement from our medical assistants. It is every single year, are there any changes in your family history? They get asked that by the medical assistant. Then they get it asked again by me to give them a second opportunity to make sure that nothing has changed. And in case they forgot to mention it the first time. So we are doing it on a routine and regular basis, but that is one of the biggest. So we have barriers on both sides.
I totally agree. And I think when you put that in an Epic space, it lives there forever. You have to update it, update. And I'll give you an example. You know, I do a lot of prenatal genetics and carrier screening and so forth and so on. It's interesting when we look at that space in young reproductive couples, it's been suggested that only 25% of the population of that group of people can identify all four of their grandparents. If you can't, again, so if you can't even identify who they are, where they live, and so forth and so on, because the world has changed. Well, that is really the issue. Now you throw things in like being adopted or being raised, and that even kind of raises the bar even more. So this is why that even when you take a good genetic history, you think you're taking a good genetic history, you think you're taking a good family history, but if you don't really recall that and put that in the in your record, you can't do proper risk assessment, because maybe your risk assessment needs to even kick up a notch when you think about those type of deficits in people's knowledge.
Yeah, and you know, from in residencies and seeing patients and everything, I mean, especially looking at workflows now, you know, you brought up Epic and EMRs, you know, a lot of times the MD or the DO or the MP isn't even, you know, taking that family history. I mean, it's coming in through surveys and things like that when patients are in waiting rooms. And yeah, to your point, I mean, no one's going back and, you know, verifying that data. It's just being pulled in automatically into a provider note. So, you know, that's been a problem. There's nothing new there. I mean, you know, we collectively in healthcare haven't been good at family histories for many decades. So.
This next question, Tom, is really very good, and it's by Andrew. And this is something that I have prided myself on in every community that I used to live in, because I would do a lot of health fairs and women's health fairs, and I do them at the church and all kinds of things. And basically, you know, so because, you know, if I did a women's health Saturday, I was talking to the people who really about their whole women's health issue. I did a lot. I mean, I get them, you would be surprised. Yeah, I think I'm an OBGYN, but I get in there, and really the people I was talking to them about menopause. I was talking about breast cancer. I was talking about all those type of things. And they were sitting there. So we have to get to the community. All, you know, when we think about community care initiatives, this is what we can all do in our communities to get together and talk about that. And also I've worked with various organizations in the Black community, whether it be Lynx, whether it be Jack and Jill, whether it be all the, and this is where a lot of individuals and put on programs for them. So that's where the advocacy is. What we're doing with the healthcare navigation program, for instance, in South Florida is really just about that. We got people who are willing to work with us, like you know, Nancy Brinker, who is the Susan B. Coleman's sister. And she has put this together, this whole healthcare navigation program for us to be able to kind of get out and do that. So our next focus, quite honestly, is to bring back mobile mammography and not park it at Nordstrom's like I did when I was in Indiana, but parking it at Dollar General and parking it at Walmart and doing those type of things. Because when you put those things out there, that's what we have to do. We have to kind of get back into the community and really engage people where they are.
I agree with that, Haywood. One of the other things I have reached out to patients, you know, we're getting ready to go into the holiday season. Mm-hmm. So this is the perfect opportunity. Every single year when I see patients around this time and right after the holidays, I'm like, this is an opportunity. You've got Thanksgiving, to have even the, you know, all of the, you know, the Muslim holidays, the Jewish holidays, the Christian holidays, everybody is getting together. This is a perfect opportunity to go and sit next to grandma or, you know, great Aunt Susie and, you know, Aunt Martha and Aunt Latoya and all of these folks and sit them down and ask them the questions. And I'll tell you, you know, from year to year, I have patients coming back who, even if I see them in, say, June or July, they say, you know what, I remember what you said about talking to my family members at Thanksgiving. And at Thanksgiving dinner, we sat it down and everybody and laid out everything. And that is the, you know, so in addition to, you know, reaching people where they are, we have to tell our patients, go and reach your people where they are. You know, your people are at the Thanksgiving, at the Christmas table. You know, this is the opportunity. New Year's dinners, get all of these folks together, ask the information, ask the questions, because the collective memory is very powerful. A lot of people kind of recall bits and pieces of information. You're able to put things together to get a better idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And even, you know, heart disease, I think even, you know, yeah, everything.
Everything.
All encompassing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it starts a discussion. And, you know, and I think sometimes even what I found is I had a patient who was very similar to this, a young lady, she was 68. We had taken care of her in our practice. And she had a history of uterine and endometrial cancer. And we took care of her. She was followed by the oncologist. She, you know, recovered, did great. This lady had, I think, either eight children. And she also had a history of lots of colon polyps. So I'm sure everybody on here hears and knows that she's screening Lynch syndrome. We threw a little informational gathering when I first joined my current practice, where we had some wine and cheese and said, hey, if you want to know more about your family cancer history, let's have a chat. We'll test you. Let's see what's going on. We tested this lady. She has Lynch syndrome. You know what she did with that information? It was right around October, actually. We did it for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And that November, she talked to her children. 5 out of the 8 were Lynch carriers. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew. We had taken care of her maybe 8 years prior. We didn't say anything. Her oncologist didn't say anything. Nobody told her. She was never even tested. So yeah. This, you know, so these opportunities, you know, to really go and inform and pass the information through the family is absolutely imperative.
Yeah. And you know, that brings up, you know, cascade testing. And, you know, as a country, we've largely failed, I would argue, you know, at that and across the board. I can't think of any studies off the top of my head, though, that have actually looked at that across different ethnicities and ancestry. So that would be really, you know, an interesting study. If anyone's aware, please let me know. But we need to do better as a whole there, either way.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, I just remember, you know, my mother died many years ago, but not, you know, but she was well in her 90s. And I remember that her healthcare was so important to her. And every year after she was about 70 some, she said, I'm not going to have any more mammograms because it'll be done. You know, I said, Mom, you're going to live for a long time. So you need to stop saying that. And so lo and behold, you know, even when she was really well into her late 70s, it was like, I got to get in and get my mammogram. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, she would say that to my sister. She would say that to her neighbors. And I said, well, what are you thinking? Why do you even bother to do that? And she said, well, you know, if you're going to live, I may as well try to live without cancer.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if people take that attitude, she was one of my best people when she lived with me in Indiana, and she did the old, you know, whole church women's health forum. You know, she was all very vocal. Not she was very proud of the fact that I'm sitting up in the audience talking about menopause, number one. But she was also like, you know, telling people to ask the questions. So everybody needs that go-to person who can realistically talk in the community and focus on this education that we need to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's nothing like that.
Yeah. What have you seen, Dr. Brown, on the national level? What types of efforts are you seeing? I mean, I know we've been talking about the community going where people are, but I'm just curious about over, you know, kind of air support.
Well, we've gotten a good, you know, again, I'm trying to take that whole work that we've now done with maternal mortality, infant mortality, disparities in health outcomes, and have a national audience with that. And so we presented last year, for instance, at ACOG. I think we had a wonderful presentation at ACOG last year. People were asking the questions. They were so engaged. So ACOG is getting an education. We're going to actually mm-hmm. present at District 2 as well this whole issue of disparity. So the more and more people that we educate, next year I have an opportunity, for instance, I'm presenting again this year at the Women's Health Nurse Practitioner Meeting. Believe it or not, I'm talking about prenatal genetics. But guess what I'm throwing in? I'm throwing a little breast cancer genetics in it as well. The reason being is because it's going to spur someone to say, oh my God, you know, if I'm getting carrier screening and I find that I'm got this or I got that, it really kind of throws the thing out. The reason it's also so important, you know, is that we have cousins, we have children, and we have and we're going to have grandchildren. So when we begin to kind of think about these type of things, we really have to educate very broadly. And this is why when you identify an individual, they are your best educators for that family,
Yeah.
And so forth and so on. So that's really what we're trying to do nationally. But also we have to think about equity. ACOG talks about equity, equity, equity all the time, and we have to get out there and preach it. I really believe that.
We have a question here. Any thoughts on providing access to hereditary cancer risk assessment services in very rural areas? How can this be impacted?
Yes. So let me just say this, you know, as I said, 50% of all counties in the United States do not have a practicing OBGYN. Almost every well women's clinic, whether it be federal qualified or so forth and so on, has a women's health nurse practitioner. So we got to think about this much more broadly in terms of how we do this family history and basically 99.9% of people is caring and giving unbiased counseling. And so when I think about what you just said, as we talk about our navigation program and how we want to bring healthcare back to the rural communities, we're really talking about getting back to some things that we know. You know, the dentists are great about taking the smile mobile to rural communities and dealing with things. We have to get back to those type of things, bring it to where people are, you know, with transportation being issues and so forth and so on. So I'm a very strong believer in rural healthcare and how we can improve rural healthcare. I would tell people that once I retire, you know, I'm going to have, I'm joining all with Doctors Within Borders, not Doctors Without Borders, because we got to kind of get to these communities and do different types of things. I'll give you one example of something. I have a friend in Greece. What they do every year is they gather a group of physicians and nurses, and they sail all of the Grecian islands and bring healthcare to all of the islands that are very remote and so forth and so on. They spend 2 or 3 days. They're taken care of by the families. It's all free. Now, if we could just do that kind of stuff around here, think about how powerful that is.
Yeah. You know?
I don't know. I actually have volunteered to go to Greece and do that next summer. But I think I probably need to do it here rather than doing it.
Yeah, because rural communities, I mean, they are islands, you know, there's really not a lot of difference sometimes. I mean, you can drive in and out, you don't have to take a boat or a plane, but yeah, it's same concept for sure.
But I think it all surrounds the advocacy and trying to get, you know, I think opportunities like this and forums like this, the more we get the information out to providers like ourselves and making sure that we educate the rest of our colleagues that underserved areas are deserving of, you know, just because they have access to care. Access is not the same if you have to drive 3 and 4 hours to exactly. Treat your provider rather than going down the street like I can, and I have 5 different mammography locations that I can choose from. Right. And the same point, you know, the quality of care. We want to make sure, as we mentioned, you know, digital breast tomosynthesis is the standard of care now, you know, so if you are going, you have to drive 3 hours and you're going to get a CT trained radiologist who's not used to reading mammography,
who's
going to read your mammogram, that is not equal access. And that is not fair and equitable care. So just like we saw with recent Medicaid expansion, you know, I'm happy to live in a state that now provides 12 months of postpartum Medicaid, benefits. And I know that that's really something that ACOG has really been pushing for years. I think this now the notion of fair and equitable care for, you know, hereditary for breast cancer is really the next step. I think it's the next push that we see. And I really am hoping that all underserved areas, rural and urban areas that are underserved, are going to get the type of care that they also deserve.
Yeah.
You hit a big point. Our push for postpartum Medicaid extension to 12 months is really about the future of women's health care. And so if you have a woman who is in late 30s, 40s now, that's part of the coverage. You keep in mind that people, when we did the whole Affordable Care Act, preventive screening was part of that. Preventive screenings was part of that. And that was just kind of the Medicaid expansion type approach. A number of states didn't do that. But the reality is we still have an obligation to think about this. And this is why when we look at who should be talked to, the age is 30, the age is 35, the age is well before 40, that we do all these type of things. And that's a re-education of our whole population health dynamics.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have time for one more question. Anything else out there? This has been a fantastic discussion. Anything on your end, Shelley?
Nope, nothing on my end. Thank you.
Okay.
We're flooding the chat with literature.
Thank you. I've seen a lot of that. So we'll have to make sure all the great stuff you're putting in the chat can carry over into the text of the podcast. You know, we'll sometimes post that below the podcast so people can easily look at those articles. So any closing thoughts, Dr. Brown, Dr. Stitt,
on a lot of ground. I just want to say that everybody on this this call lives in a community. They have a community. And I used to say all the time when I was interviewing residents, the applicants and my friend, I said, how would you like to be known in your community? And the idea is that we all have a role to play as we're interacting with our neighbors, as we interact, the things that you all have knowledge in, people don't have to ask you sometimes. You can say, this is what I think. And so that is the key. When we're dealing with our friends, when we're dealing with our neighbors, when we're dealing with their children, I used to not let any opportunity to go by without educating when I even had a little, you know, get together in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, okay. Because everybody knew what I did, but that is, and you believe it or not, people start asking you questions. People know that you guys are connected with with this. They'll start asking you questions if you are comfortable with dealing with that. So I would say, don't let those opportunities go by.
Yeah, that's a good point.
My final thought is, you know, just as Dr. Brown just mentioned, I think that the importance is that we empower our patients, empower our colleagues, empower just anybody that we have come into, we interact with education. If we can provide education, just as, you know, as Haywood just mentioned, every opportunity you have to educate one person, you never know what that one person might do and share that light with somebody else. Mm-hmm. But that is the only way it's going to just, you know, I like to say it passes like a virus, just, you know, touch one person, that person will touch another person and so on and so forth. And that's how we enable change in our community. And change is on the horizon. I'm so excited to see what's happening and the ability to provide fair, truly fair and equitable care for women of all ancestries, backgrounds, everything. So it's on the horizon. And I thank you for bringing, you know, this such an important point to this group. It's great. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you all. I'm going to head down and get another meeting going. I have to go down to the hospital.
So. Yeah, no, thank you for coming on. So thanks to Dr. Stitt and Dr. Brown. Really appreciate having you on. Join us September 26th for Clarity, which is a patient advocacy group for ovarian cancer. And also September 15th, we have our molecular tumor board. These have been fantastic. We put the sign in on the Myriad Live page as well. So that's a great source of education. And some of the last ones are here if you want to preview them. So again, if you want to hear Dr. Stitt a little bit more in depth, definitely join the podcast that we just did that just posted a few weeks ago. So you can listen to her until your heart is content. So thank you. Thanks everyone for coming on this early Monday morning. Appreciate it. And I want to be respectful of time. So see you next time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That was fantastic. Thanks, awesome. Shelley.